Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm your host, Corey Fleck. I appreciate all of you joining me on this wrapping up, I guess, the first full week of trading in 2021. And boy, oh boy, it was a wild week to start this year. If this week is any indication of what's going to happen for the rest of this year, it seems like 2021 might be even more historic than 2020. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it gives me a lot to talk about this week and throughout the year. I'm kicking off this weekend show with a good friend of the show, Mike Larson. He writes the Safe Money Report. Now, Mike, let's talk about the broad market environment now that we have the results from the runoff election. And we can say that there actually was a blue wave in that U.S. election. What does that mean for markets now?
Sure. Thanks again for having me on, especially here at the start of the new year. It really is amazing when you look at what 2020 included, and everybody kind of was looking forward to turning the page and starting 2021 with a clean slate. Obviously, on the political front, that's not what we got at all. I mean, we've had this crazy activity in D.C., the storming of the U.S. Capitol and so on. Clearly, from a historical and sort of political and constitutional perspective, it's shocking. It's amazing to see, and it really makes these next couple weeks interesting to see in terms of whether, you know, Trump gets impeached, whether there's even time to do it, whether his cabinet gets together and tries to just replace him according to the Constitution, Amendment 25. There's all kinds of crazy things going on that just makes you think, geez, I hope 2021 is not a sequel or just a continuation of what we had last year in terms of turmoil. But from a market perspective, if you look at just the economics of it, the market pretty much sailed right through what was going on and has been strong right out of the gate here in the start of the year. And I think that really does come down to what you mentioned, the blue wave scenario. For a number of weeks, it's been sort of looking to me like we would be entering this year and see a year with a money flood environment. Basically, the Fed continuing to pump money into the economy and the market, regardless of what happens really with inflation and economic growth. On top of that, additional huge amounts of stimulus from the Biden administration and Congress, especially if the Democrats were able to get that effective majority with the tie in the Senate and then the vice president being the tiebreaker, which is in fact what happened. That's going to turn that extra fiscal stimulus dial up all the way to 10. You look at that scenario where you have a monetary authority that's just going to be printing and buying bonds like mad and keeping rates pegged to zero for ages. And you layer on top of that this enormous amount of fiscal stimulus, everything from aid to states, $2,000 stimulus checks, tax cuts for some, some individuals and all these other incentives for things like clean energy and infrastructure spending and on and on and on. Again, it's ocean of money that's going to be flooding out of Washington towards Wall Street and the economy. And naturally, investors are looking at that and saying, you know, who cares about the longer term implications for debts and deficits? This is a party time now. So that's why you're seeing markets strong out of the gate. And indeed, it's really not just stocks. I mean, if you look at the performance in the back half of 2020, when you can kind of see the scenario coming, it wasn't just U.S. stocks. It was global stocks. It was gold. It was silver. It was mining shares. It was Bitcoin and other cryptos. I mean, really, the commodities across the board, very strong performance, indicative of a market that knows an enormous amount of money is coming its way from D.C. and from other foreign capitals.
So when it comes to policies that Biden might put in, but that Biden even campaigned on, what do you think are the ones that we will see first? What do you see is most likely to come out of the gate? Because you're right. Look, there's a party in the markets and it's all about making money now, not making money a year down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at what Chuck Schumer, the incoming Senate Majority Leader, has just said, that the first, and this confirms what the Biden administration officials have said, it's that they want to top people off with $2,000 checks. I mean, we've had 600 already. They're going to, they want to get another 1,400 thrown on top of the pile very soon. So I think that's the first priority. I think next you're going to see, you know, the things that Republicans were standing in the way of before, such as aid to state and local governments. That's probably going to be next. I think infrastructure and clean energy, especially, they want to satisfy the environmentalists, and that's a big platform there. So, you know, it's no surprise that right out of the gate, you saw ETFs and stocks that, you know, that are involved in solar and wind and everything like that soaring 7, 8, 9, 10% in a day. You know, so that kind of stuff. I think those are the top priorities that you're going to see. And later on, it's going to be broader tax and spend policies. It's going to be other things like, you know, incentivizing research and development and trying to bring manufacturing back onshore and taxing foreign, foreign-owned or foreign-earned profits and corporations, on the other hand, and taxing the wealthy, the people at the high end of the income spectrum, to pay for at least a portion, but clearly not anywhere near all of that. So again, it's a complete, you know, shift in priorities from what we had under a Trump administration. And with it, you know, with the ability to have both houses of Congress for at least the first 2 years, you know, Biden's going to have that backing to basically push a lot of this stuff through. And, you know, normally you would have a Federal Reserve that would kind of counterbalance that a little bit. But this isn't normal. This is a Fed that is convinced that, you know, if you look at what they're saying, there's a few Fed people have come out in the last few days and said, you know, we might need to taper by the end of 2021, or we might, you know, eventually look at winding this thing down. But come on. I mean, we look back at what happened coming out of the last recession under the Obama years and the Bernanke Fed, what happened, right? The economy and the stock market and everything bottomed in the first quarter of 2009. The Fed, you know, despite some talk that, oh, they might, you know, taper it, or, you know, they might get out of this QE business, they ultimately launched three rounds of QE, not just the round that was launched in the midst of the crisis. Then Bernanke didn't even start insinuating or hinting that he might raise rates until May of 2013. That caused a taper tantrum where stocks tanked and bond yields surged, which made the Fed chicken out on QE tapering all the way to December 2013. They did it over a long span of time. It took forever to wind that down. Then they didn't start raising interest rates until December 2015, which was, you know, 7, 8 years after they cut them to zero. So, you know, and that was in a scenario where the economy was in better shape ostensibly than it was in the midst of the COVID crisis. And that was in a time when you would at least expect, you know, because of the cycle before that, the Fed would do what normally happens in economic improvements. They take back the punch bowl. You know, there's no evidence whatsoever this Powell Fed has any inclination to take away the punch bowl, or, you know, when push comes to shove, if the markets even get into a little mini tantrum, I mean, forget, you know, a 3-year-old screaming, we're talking about like a little kid who has to burp and pat on the back. If the markets even do something like that, then they're going to backtrack faster than you can imagine. And it's going to be, again, it's going to be, in my opinion, a much longer stretch of pedal to the metal on QE. Rates pegged to the floor, regardless of what inflation and unemployment and growth are doing. And that just means that you're going to, again, you have a situation where the money flood is not going away now. It's only going to get bigger. And down the road, you know, it's likely that none of this stimulus is going to be withdrawn early or in advance of when it probably should. If anything, it'll happen far too late after the markets have really gone overboard.
Okay, so you are not buying into any of the recent comments from the Fed president, Hawker or Bostic, that we could be tapering by the end of next year. Hey, fair enough. And you know what? You're not alone in saying that these guys are not going to be able to follow through with that. But what about what the bond market is telling us? Because we do have, especially the long end, yields are rising. It was just this week, too, that the 10-year popped over 1%. And as we're recording, it continues to hold over that level. Do you see the Fed doing anything when it comes to yield curve control? Anything else like that?
Sure. Think of what you just said. The 10-year yield has popped over 1%.
Oh, I know. I agree. The bond market's broken.
100%. We're certainly in an environment where the idea of a bunch of fiscal stimulus and, you know, the economy getting better coming out of the worst of the COVID crisis, especially as the vaccine rollout continues, that's going to lead to higher interest rates in the short, to some degree, even intermediate term. But I think we're going to be talking about baby steps here in the bond market, not leaps and bounds. I mean, you have to remember just the way bond market math works and amortizing works. The greater amount of debt that you're trying to amortize against any given interest rate, the smaller the increase in the interest rate that you need to see before that basically breaks you. If you owe $100 and your interest rate goes up from, you know, 1% to 2%, who cares, right? You barely notice the pain in your monthly budget. if you have $100 billion and the interest rate goes from 1% to 2%, I mean, the amount that that means you're paying extra if you have a variable rate is astronomical. So because we have piled so much debt at the corporate level, at the government level, at every level on this economy, it would take a much lower level of interest rates before the whole house of cards comes crashing down, whatever metaphor you want to use. So given that that's the case, in my opinion, we're never going to see double-digit 10-year yields like we had, you know, back in the early 80s for many years. We might not even see 2% interest rates or 2.5% 10-year yield for quite some time. Because, again, when you've layered all that debt on top of an economy, much smaller increases in interest rates break things. So it's why for 30 years now, every single peak in the interest rate cycle, Fed hikes and so on, has ended at a lower and lower level of interest rates. Look at Japan. They've been pegged at or below or near zero for, what, 30, 35 years now? So, again, you know, that's kind of what we have to keep in the back of our mind. So, sure, rates could go up. They are going up. Do I think we're going to see some catastrophic increase in interest rates? No, I don't, because the fallout would be enormous.
That is fair. But now what about on the flip side when we talk about inflation, balancing out inflation break-evens? Those are also rising. The 10-year inflation break-even is at levels we haven't seen since mid-2018. Let's start with inflation and the potential that that carries this year in terms of, I don't know, throwing the Fed off course, doing anything, actually.
You know, I think that the Fed has already said, if you go back to their own, you know, statements, they've said they want inflation above their old 2% target for a period of time to balance out the period of time during which inflation was below 2%. So again, is the Fed going to react to, you know, the sort of inflation rate at 2%, 2.25%, 2.5%, even 3%? No, they're going to say that's a good thing. They say, well, it's been 1.5 or 1 for so long. We want it to, you know, average 2.5 or 3 to get back to this average 2 level. So, you know, it's a new regime in sort of Fed policy. It's a new way of thinking. Unless the bond market absolutely forces the Fed's hand, which, again, is going to be very hard in terms of its impact on – it'll be a self-destructive move, right? If interest rates start soaring, again, given the debt-laden economy and given sort of the valuations built into the stock market that are all dependent on, you know, low rates forever, it's going to take a much smaller amount of interest rate increase to break things, for things to get ugly. So that's why I think that, you know, again, the level to which interest rates can rise is a lot lower than it was in the past. And again, why the Fed's going to do all it can to avoid that outcome.
Yep. Hey, fair enough. The Fed is in there. The Fed has told everyone that they're going to be in there, even if they haven't done it in some of their statements. But either way, everyone knows that the Fed has their back when it comes to the bond market. Can I also get your comments on this U.S. dollar? It continues to break down. Well, it's close to breaking down. There are a lot of arguments, whether it has already broken down, whether it is breaking down. Where do you stand on the dollar action?
Sure. I mean, if you look at something like the DXY, the dollar index, it is, you know, it's broken some technical levels of support. It hasn't completely fallen out of bed. It's been more of a steady decline. But, you know, that in an environment where we're in the sort of print, borrow, and spend forever environment, where we're in one where asset reflation isn't just a side effect, it's a goal of policymakers. And when you layer in, again, sort of this deterioration that we're going to see in the U.S. balance sheet as a result of the enormous amount of borrowing and spending that's going to go on, you know, I tend to, I'm not a huge dollar bear, but I do tend to think it's going to continue to sink here. And as if you're a U.S.-based investor, that's all the more reason to be looking at things like gold, silver, mining shares, and even some high-yielding foreign stocks or ETFs. So I think given that scenario, what would spike the dollar? It would have to be some kind of panic, you know, fleeing back into dollar assets, which of course is going to be accompanied by, you know, other ugly things like a collapsing stock market. And, you know, I don't really think that's the likeliest scenario. I think the slow bleed scenario that we've seen in the dollar is likely what we're going to continue to see, you know, for the foreseeable future. So again, from a policy and an economic standpoint, I think the move we've seen so far in DXY is right. And I don't really see any reason for it to change anytime soon.
Yeah, fair enough. And it's very easy to tell on the chart, too, that any sort of bounce is getting sold into. So yeah, that tells you a lot about the dollar. Let's wrap it up with a comment on commodities then, because you have mentioned a wide range of commodities, everything from precious metals to base metals to clean energy type of commodities. Which ones do you see outperforming? Because some are going to do better than others. Do you have insights on that?
Sure. You know, earlier I have been a little skeptical of base versus precious metals. I prefer precious to base. You kind of were trying to steer me in the base direction, and you were right. So congratulations on that one. I think that clearly, if you look at what's going on with things like copper and so on, it's a response to the stimulus. It's a response to the economy coming back from the worst of the COVID dark days back in the spring of 2020. And I think that, you know, again, if you believe, you know, I'm certainly warming to that. And I'm certain, especially for something like silver, which has a little bit of both the precious exposure and the economic exposure. I think that looks really solid to me. So I think that in this sort of asset reflationary environment, but one that's not going to be shut down quickly by rising interest rates, in my opinion, especially policy directly controlled rates, there's a lot of potential there. So I think, you know, and especially, again, especially after the blue wave results in the election, that's going to be a lot of concrete money coming into the economy and in the real economy, not just the asset market. So I think you throw that all together and that those kinds of trades you're seeing, the rebound in oil, for example, all of that stuff is probably going to be with us for a while. So I don't think you fade that move.
So I guess in summary, it's sounding like 2021 is the year to be invested. Make sure you are invested, obviously be diversified. But if you're sitting in cash, just like in 2020, that would be a losing trade.
Yeah, I think the one last thing I'd put in here is that you've got to be very careful about when bullish market behavior turns into euphoria. And, you know, there are some worrisome signs on that regard. If you look at this avalanche of money losing IPO direct that Wall Street's dumping on the market and all these SPACs, these special purpose acquisition companies, where they don't even have a business, they just go out and raise billions of dollars because of whoever the guy is sitting behind the desk. And they say maybe someday we'll actually buy a business that someday actually delivers profits. You know, that kind of stuff, you're seeing a lot of that really junky issuance. You're seeing junk bond yields at all-time lows. I mean, there are some things that again, you want to keep in the back of your mind and just say, hey, is this still bullish or are we in the euphoria stage? And if we're in the, you know, if we make that transition, you know, that's when you got to start unloading and selling into as opposed to continuing to buy things and lever up on. So, you know, those are the things I'd keep in the back of my mind. But all in all, for now and probably for a while, this money flood environment is going to be with us. And leaning against that is probably not the best thing to do.
All right, Mike, great chatting with you, buddy. Thanks for kicking off the New Year's show. I guess last weekend was also the New Year's show, but now we actually have market moves to talk about for 2021. And boy, oh boy, again, it's been a wild week. If anybody wants to follow Mike, I recommend following Mike on Twitter, @RealMikeLarson. He's posting all day, every day with a lot of valuable insights. So I'm a follower and it really helps you stay on top of everything that's going on. Mike, again, great chatting with you. Have a great rest of your weekend, buddy.
Thank you. You too.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this segment, I am chatting with Sean Broderick. He's an analyst over at Weiss Ratings, also writes or is the editor of the Wealth Megatrends Report. Now, Sean joins me about every 2 weeks on the show, and we discuss a wide range of topics. In all fairness, Sean, you and I have talked precious metals, we've talked U.S. equity markets, we've talked cannabis, we've talked cryptos. You do keep your finger on the pulse for a wide range of markets. And what I have to ask you is, now that we're in 2021, and quite frankly, you look back onto 2020, and almost every market did well. It sounds crazy to say that because of how tough 2020 was, and still how tough daily life is for a lot of people heading into 2021. Fact of the matter is, the markets are doing very well. So what's your strategy as we are now in this new year and we just finished last year where everything did well? And quite frankly, I'm hearing a lot of bullish comments about a wide range of sectors. Where are you focusing?
Well, let me give you just a little look back, and actually a longer look back at like something else. You have to go through a little history. One reason I believe that markets and everything else did so well last year is that we saw the U.S. dollar collapse by 13% last year from its highs in February, I believe, something about 13%, which is a huge move in a currency, and that's continuing right now. So we saw things go up in 2020 as the currency went down, because as the currency becomes cheaper, you know, it takes more of it to actually buy things. That includes stocks. And in fact, let me ask you a question. And if you don't know, that's okay. What was the best performing stock market in 2007?
Sean, I know you too well that I don't stand a chance of getting this right, but I'll say Argentina. Why not?
It was the stock market in Zimbabwe. Now, what happened in Zimbabwe in 2007? Its currency collapsed. And the reason that the stock market did so well is because as the currency became worth less and less, those things that had at least some real value, and those stocks had some real value, became more and more expensive. They just went soaring. Now we're seeing the U.S. dollar go lower and lower, including now. I mean, it's already started the year falling out of bed. Of course, hard assets are going to go higher. Of course, stocks are going higher. And this is happening because the U.S. Central Bank and other important central banks around the world are printing like crazy. They did this as an initial response to get their economies out of the morass that they sank into during the pandemic. You know, I mean, everything came to a halt. But now the markets have become addicted to it. It's very, very hard to tell a junkie they can't have any more junk when you, in fact, hook them on that junk in the first place. And that's what we're seeing. Now, a lot could really change this year. Two things could happen. Either the Republicans will suddenly discover that they hate deficit spending. I mean, should say rediscover. They hated it for a while, and then Trump became president. They loved it. Now they might hate it again. And so if they do that, then they could become very miserly, and that could actually be a monkey wrench in things for the market. So people have to keep that in mind. However, we could see things work out for the Democrat if they, for the Democrats if they win two Senate seats that were at stake in Georgia this past week. You and I don't know the election results now. Maybe people will by the time that they hear this. The odds are against them. I think it's more likely that the Republicans will win. But if they don't, I should say, if the Democrats do win, then they'll get to pursue all of the big spending programs that we know Joe Biden wants to do. Green energy, rebuilding infrastructure, all sorts of things. And that's all going to cost money. Now, he can still do that to a certain extent, even if the Republicans are like pulling the brakes on spending. There's still things he can do. So that could still send the dollar lower, especially if our economy starts to underperform other economies around the world. But it'll be much easier for him to spend a lot more money if the Democrats are in charge. So as you and I are speaking, we are in kind of a limbo right now. It doesn't mean that I'm not adding new positions. I think gold's going to have a great year. We just saw gold break a five-month downtrend on huge volume. So that's a big move. That shows that there's a lot of interest in gold because people can see all this debt piling up that's never going to be paid off. They can see the like printing presses at all the central banks around the world going like crazy, devaluing fiat currency. They can see this happening. And that makes precious metals more and more appealing. But it makes other things appealing as well. Other hard assets, things like copper. And of course, there's other things for copper. We can look at like the what's happening with electric vehicles, which are just roaring. They roared last year. Even when everyone thought, well, you know, that's it. No one's going to buy anything. People are buying electric cars, especially in places like China and Europe. We are going to see a lot more of it this year. And that fuels demand not only for copper, for lithium, for nickel, for all sorts of things. And so there is going to be tremendous demand, which could be supercharged by further devaluation of the dollar. That's the point that I'm getting to. I think we are seeing a boom in demand anyway, which is kind of cyclical. But that could really be supercharged by a falling U.S. dollar if things work out for, I guess, the Democrats or anybody who wants to spend money in Washington. That's actually hard to say at this point.
Okay. So, yeah, as you outlined, we are recording this before we know the results of those runoff races in Georgia. But if, let's say, the Democrats surprise and they do take those seats, then we could be seeing a very different environment. But overall, it does sound like a big focus is on this U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar continues to break down. The argument being, yes, that the Fed, the U.S. government, they are going to be printing a lot more money, but so are a lot of other countries, right? And the one thing that we have seen is that the spending bills that have been proposed, the ones that have been passed, have been far less than what were proposed on the front end. But then we're also balancing out other countries that are going through more extreme lockdowns than in the U.S. How important is it going to be to follow the whole COVID story this year when it comes to market moves, but also taking into account that some of these news events and COVID news can cause short-term volatility, but longer-term trends can still remain in place?
Yeah, well, I think that the COVID story is going to last longer than most people think. And I hate to say that. Hate to be the guy who's upsetting the punch bowl at this point, but I'm just looking at the stocks I have because I have pandemic-related stocks in my portfolios, and those are doing as well as the gold stocks now. Lakeland Industries, for example, symbol LAKE. They make protective gear, you know, and they're just taking off again. Partly this is due to the terrible rollout we've had of vaccines, where they're just handing it out piecemeal to states, leaving the states with, like, I don't know what we're going to do with it. And so they had hoped to get, like, I think something like 20 million people vaccinated by the end of the year. Instead, they got 2 million. So it's going to take longer to roll out the vaccine. That's one thing for sure. We can see that already. And then we have the super strain of COVID-19, which is over in Britain, which spreads, it depends on who you listen to, between 40 and 60% easier than the strain we're used to. It's already in California. It's already in Florida. We're probably going to see this spread around the U.S. What does that mean? I am not a doctor. I don't even play one on TV. But this tells me we're probably going to see another wave of this damnable virus spreading around again. So, you know, that's horrible. I have a mom who's over 80. That's really horrible. But I don't think we're done with the virus, and I don't think the virus is done with us. I think that is going to be a continuing story, at least through the first half of 2021. Now, can we have economic growth despite that? Yes, because people are adaptable, and people are adapting how they work, and like all these businesses are like rejigging things. We're seeing so much move online. We're seeing so much move remotely, and so we can still have great economic growth, but we can still have certain segments of the economy really under the crushing heel of this stupid pandemic because it could drag on a lot longer than many people realize.
Okay, let's go back to some of these commodities then that you like moving forward, even outside of a lot of this noise that we're seeing in terms of news events and even market volatility. Where are you finding value in some of these commodities when, quite frankly, they've all done quite well?
They have, and especially if you look at things like, you know, uranium stocks and stuff like that, marijuana stocks, they've just been roaring. That's true. But one ratio that I like to look at is the valuation of the gold stocks, and I think we use the Philadelphia Gold Bugs Index for this, which is the longest gold index, gold miners index that has actually been around. Use that ratio against the S&P 500, and it is at a multi-decade low. because the stocks in the S&P 500 have inflated so much, and gold stocks haven't. You know, you can find real value in the gold miners. It's really, really good. I think you can find value in copper, and despite the recent run-up, you can find value in uranium stocks as well. I mean, because everybody hated that market for so long, not hated really, disappointed, because they were promised year after year after year, we're going to see a bull market in uranium. And that bull market never came. Well, guess what? Now we're finally having one, but many people have been so burned. I mean, they lost so much money in these uranium stocks, they don't want to buy them, or at least not yet. That time will come. So I would look at those things. I would look at lithium. You know, I mean, that's just enormous megatrend for those EVs all over the world. I'd look at solar. I mean, even if Joe Biden doesn't get his green energy bill or whatever it's called passed, globally, there's a mega trend in the solar power industry because it's just becoming cheaper and cheaper and cheaper to actually make all the equipment. And so it's now getting cheaper to do that than even natural gas, which we all thought was going to be the cheapest for a long, long time. So there's a lot of places to find value. Tech is like scary. I mean, because the stratospheric valuations in tech, I can understand that. And I still think you can find value in tech. You have to be very careful, but it's much easier to find it in things like gold and silver miners and stuff like that, especially if what we think happens and the US dollar goes down in value over the next year. Well, that means that the profit margins for those companies are just going to widen like the Grand Canyon. So of course they're going to do much better. And so I think that's a place people should be looking. But again, not just gold and silver. Look at copper, look at uranium, look at lithium. There's a whole bunch of things you should be looking at right now.
Okay, so just a quick note here. When it comes to uranium, the uranium stocks have just been screaming higher. It almost doesn't matter which uranium stock you are looking at. It's been just moving aggressively higher, but the uranium price has not been. It's been fairly flat. Why is that disconnect happening, and doesn't that make you at least a little bit cautious there entering uranium because it is getting so hyped?
I try to buy pullbacks. I mean, we own one in like Supercycle Invest from there. Oh, come on. I mean, am I crazy to hold this thing? But here's the thing. We can see a supply-demand gap that's forecast. Right. And it was made worse this past year because of all the uranium mines that had to shut down due to the stupid pandemic, a pandemic which now threatens to drag on longer than other people thought. And the big government uranium mining corporation in Kazakhstan sold a 49% interest in two of its big mines to China. So a bunch of that uranium, which was going to go to the world market, is probably now going to go to China. You would think that would be kind of a two-handed deal, right? We'll invest in your mines. They needed money in Kazakhstan because they'd been hit by this pandemic like nobody's business. So we'll invest in these mines. You sell us the uranium. You can see that happening. So there's probably going to be less supply, and not just because of the pandemic shutdowns, because big, hungry countries like China, which has a huge nuclear power program, is going to be, you know, just gobbling up more and more uranium around the world. So we can see the supply-demand gap. Now, the reason people don't believe the supply-demand gap is because we've been told about this for the last decade, and it's never really materialized. I think what we're seeing in the uranium stocks right now is finally they are starting to see more exploratory bids from these utilities around the world that need uranium. I mean, they just need it. And they're just buying on the spot market, right? Because it's always been cheaper and cheaper. But now the price is going higher. The price is going higher in the spot market because suddenly there's more and more demand for it because people hadn't been buying. They've been putting off buying for as long as they could. Now, I could be wrong. Uranium could roll over again, and then I'll feel like an idiot. But if you look at what we know now about the fundamentals in the uranium industry, it points toward higher prices. We've seen the price kind of drift along and just pick up a little bit. I don't think just that last little pickup could light these stocks on fire the way that's been happening. I believe that it's this long-term supply-demand squeeze that's been forecast for so long is finally starting to crystallize. That's what people are seeing. They are starting to bid ahead of that. And so there certainly will be pullbacks. You know, and so you don't have to chase anything. There's going to be, in fact, I think the last 3 days before today, uranium stocks were actually pulling back pretty good. So, but there could be deeper pullbacks. Wait for those pullbacks. Then, and you shouldn't, well, of course, I'm sure you tell your listeners this all the time. You shouldn't bet all your money on one horse. Spread the money around. you know, because you don't know which ones are going to win. You can have an idea. There aren't that many uranium miners. So, you know, but you might want to own like at least a half dozen, because that's how you're really going to win this race, I believe.
Yeah, fair enough. But you know what? We have heard just year after year, this supply-demand deficit, right? And maybe now it's finally going to come, but the underlying uranium price isn't showing that. But boy, oh boy, the stocks really are. Let's wrap it up diving into the copper stocks then, because copper stocks, they're still a small sector, but there are more stocks out there to invest in on top of, say, uranium or either lithium. And some of these copper stocks have been around for a lot longer, whether that's good or bad. How are you isolating the good copper stocks to invest in when you do have some of these long life copper plays that just need a lot of money to get built? But it seems like though there are quite a few of those assets out there. There are some new exploration plays that have popped up in the copper space. Where are you focusing?
So far, I've been avoiding the exploration plays for the simple reason you mentioned. It takes so much money to actually start up a copper mine that I'm worried that I'll just be completely diluted by the time they actually get into production. I've been looking at those that actually produce and those with near-term production. Those are the ones that I'm looking at. However, you know, that's just what I'm looking at now. Next week, I might start to look at the explorers because this market changes all the time. But right now, or I should say this week, copper tested the high that it put in late last year. We'll have to see what's happening, but it sure looks like the metal wants to break out again. It's over 350, and that's really the dividing line between people being interested in copper and people not being interested in copper. And so it's still early days in the copper market. If we're seeing a big bull market, like I believe we are, partly due to electronic vehicles, but also due to infrastructure and just building more stuff around the world, it's not just EVs that use copper. Everything uses copper. So because of that, we're probably looking at a big bull market in copper. So you can pick up a couple stocks and do pretty well, or at least I believe you can.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunities right there, especially in some of these hard assets and commodities broadly. But I think it's all about keeping a level head and being diversified. As you said, you don't need to be all in on one stock. You don't need to be all in on one commodity either. But a lot of positivity as we entered 2021 and the way that, well, the first week traded, that positivity has carried over. Sean, great chatting with you, buddy. Thanks for taking time on this weekend show. Have a great rest of your weekend.
You too.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition. I am joined by Axel Merk, President and Chief Investment Officer of Merk Investments. Axel, I've covered a lot of topics on this weekend show already, and I want to summarize this last segment by first touching on gold miners and a webinar that the Merk team is hosting Thursday, January 14th at 4:15 p.m. Eastern Time. I will post a link to register for that webinar, but let's talk a little bit about gold miners and that overall sector. Undoubtedly, that these gold miners are producing better financials. They're earning more money thanks to a higher gold price, and we have seen them build up some nice cash balances. What's your overall assessment of the health of gold miners generally?
Yeah, happy new year. Well, and for the kind promotion of our webinar, you just mentioned cash generation and gold miners. That's fantastic on the one hand, but that's also in some ways a double-edged sword, right? At the moment, many people invest in gold miners because they want to have a leverage play on the price of gold, and they've been getting that in this cycle. But of course, the moment these gold miners generate a lot of cash, you reduce some of that leverage. And so they get pressured then from investors to do something with that. And depending on what they do, they may or may not get rewarded. And so this is not success is a double-edged sword. And importantly, of course, the part of the reason why the economics are working so well for the majors is because they've underinvested in recent years, and so their balance sheets look a lot better. But they will be facing pressure to make up for that by gaining ounces and acquiring downstream. Now, throughout kind of the capital structure, the different miners have on different situations. The kind of the juniors and explorers have had access to cash mostly last spring, last summer, and then as the markets got a little rougher, the price of gold was selling off a little bit. Window hasn't closed yet, but it's become a little bit more selective. And of course, yes, to the extent that people want to see leverage, we think the sweet spot is in the more junior end. Now that said, as anybody who's ever invested in miners is concerned, it's a very speculative space. And we can look at it a little bit like a quasi private equity space. I say quasi because many of these junior companies are public, but they're really only public because they need to continuously raise capital every other year or every couple of years, and so they want to have the right structure for that available. But you really want to know what you're doing, and don't expect every investment that you make to actually pay off.
Absolutely, especially the small companies and the exploration companies. It's a risky game, but it can be profitable. Back to the gold miners, though. If I'm using something like GDX, which is the gold miners ETF, you can still make the argument that this ETF is undervalued compared to where the underlying gold price is. You go back to when gold was last at about $1,900, and fair enough, that was when the market was rolling over into a bear market, but GDX was about 30 to 40% higher than where it currently is. So what do you think about this so-called disconnect?
Yeah, so I'm not going to get an investment recommendation on anything specific. That said, I agree with you that the valuations are lower compared to the last cycle. And that has several reasons. One of them, investors that were in the previous cycle, many of them got burned because the economics did not work out. Companies were not particularly prudent. And so this time around, you have, I think, still only the early phases of people embracing the sector. And a lot of people also think they missed the boat. We don't think so. And then just to kind of give a little reason why we don't think so, we think that the price of gold is, if anything, correlated to real interest rates. That means interest net of inflation and not so much short term, but 10-year rates. So if you look at the 10-year tips, for example, and if you now think that interest rates are going to be glued to zero or near zero for an extended period, but the economy is going to pick up, that means on a real basis, odds are that interest rates are going to get more negative. And so we think that's a very supportive environment for the miners. And yes, because of the low valuations or lower valuations than they've had in previous cycles, we think that many of these companies can be quite profitable. Also, many of these companies are using something like $1,300 for the price of gold to run the models, right? And that's how they operate. They don't assume when the price of gold goes up, hey, yep, $1,900 is what we need. No, they don't make a business decision unless they think they can be profitable at $1,300. We're obviously watching very carefully how these sort of judgments are revised as the price of gold has been moving higher. But for the time being, the discipline we see continues to be quite good.
Yeah, that real interest rate comment you made really ties into the first couple of segments when we were talking about Fed policy, especially when it comes to potential yield curve control and the fact that we are seeing inflation expectations rise. But a comment about M&A here, you've mentioned it a couple times that these majors, the gold miners, are eventually going to get forced to get more aggressive in terms of M&A. Do you think they're going to make the same mistakes as last bull market?
Well, eventually, that's how you define the end of the bull market. But I don't think we're there. So at some point, yes, they'll make mistakes. If we get what we expect to get, a significantly higher price of gold, at some point, the discipline is going to deteriorate. I mean, that's just the nature of how these markets work, that over time, you'll broaden the investor base. You get some other folks jump in. Currently, the speculators all gang-ho about Bitcoin. And so we're a little shielded from the excesses of those folks. And so it it might take longer to get there, but yes, at some point we'll be there. I just happen to think that this is going to be a while, and we're going to be in a sweet spot here for a considerable period.
All right, one more comment regarding the gold stocks and driving down into the smaller exploration plays. I know that we can't chat individual stocks, but what are some of the characteristics or jurisdictions, or what are some of the keys, I guess I can say, that you look for in some of these smaller companies?
Well, obviously the location, the management teams, but the management team is one of the most important things, because those have trust in the community. What you need to, as I mentioned earlier, these companies need to have access to financing to finance the next phase in their project. And then they may be good for 2 years or 3 years, and then they need financing again. And so if you are a newcomer, you might have the best field in the world, but if you don't know how to raise money, that's a problem. And the traditional providers of capital, they have less capital than they used to. Think about the big mutual funds. During the bear market, they had a lot of outflows. They got stuck with a lot of quote-unquote legacy assets. And so they have less flexibility than in the old days than they used to have. And so it's one of the reasons why Merck has become a kind of one of the first stops for many of these junior companies to come, because we have the ability to fund many of these projects. And then what you're looking for, even when we participate, we look for other strong partners, right? Because you need to have other strong partners in there, because you want to make sure, or at least you want to have a good likelihood, that the next time these guys need financing, that others will be around to provide that capital. And so we can look at many things, but it's just like anything else, right? If you look in the markets or in any innovation, there are some kids with great ideas, but unless they know how to put the pieces of the puzzle together, it's no good. And so similarly, you need to have this package work. If you know a jurisdiction, even a more difficult one, you can make things work. There are people that specialize in that. So that's not necessarily a deterrent. And so it's really, you got to look at everything. You need to look obviously at the asset, but you look at the team and their ability to execute.
Okay, let's talk more broadly about commodities, other commodities outside of the precious metals. Look, everything's been running. You can make an argument that it's pretty much a bull market across the board, except for in the US dollar and, I guess, bonds, treasuries. But the fact of the matter is, we have copper breaking out, other base metals are breaking out, energy is breaking out, even clean energy. It's across the board, a bull market. What other commodities outside of, let's say, gold are you interested in right now?
Well, we mostly deal in gold. That said, we obviously monitor everything else. And by the way, some people have said, why do you bother investing in anything other than the S&P 500 when everything goes up in parallel? And that may be the case, but these correlations phase in and out. We don't like it that everything is very highly correlated right now, but we don't think that is going to persist forever. We are in a global reflationary environment. Both fiscal and monetary policies are going full throttle. And so that tends to carry with it a weaker dollar and higher commodity prices and also higher risk assets. And so we like it that oil prices are starting here to be stronger and in many other things. The challenge, of course, with many of these assets is, well, how do you buy them, right? In gold, we talked about, you can buy the metal and you can buy the mining companies. If you, in many of these commodities, you've got to be really good with the derivatives. And when we saw the negative print on oil prices, it showed you better know what you're doing, right? And so in any of these markets, they have their idiosyncrasies. And I would certainly not want to encourage anybody to go down a rabbit hole that they don't fully understand.
That is good advice there, but boy, oh boy, it is easy to understand why some people do get sucked into these hot sectors, but even through my background in this sector, I know that these fads can come and go, but hey, some of these resources and commodities look like they have a bit more of a long life bull market ahead of them. Let's wrap it up with a quick comment on currencies, because the US dollar, it has been on a lot of people's radar, and whether you argue that it has already broken down or is very close to breaking down, either way, the dollar's been weak and a lot of outlooks and projections are for the dollar to stay weak. Where do you stand when it comes to the US dollar?
Sure. Well, in the short term, there seems to be, especially hedge funds appear to have gone out of, you mentioned treasuries, that has pushed the yields higher in the long end of the yield curve, and that has temporarily given a bit of a boost to the dollar. That said, I do think we had a turning point turning from a secular bull to a secular bear market about a year ago, maybe in last March, and maybe more notably. And again, as we try to, quote unquote, reflate the world, it means that people are going to borrow in dollars to invest in other assets in emerging markets. It's also why I think that on the kind of outside of the gold space, not just value, but emerging market equities may well outperform. Again, this is an investment advice. It's just based on quote unquote, everybody trying to get us back on our feet and much of that money not being deployed very efficiently. It means it's going to flow into asset prices and to commodities, right? And the one of the victims along the way is the U.S. dollar. And sure, that's not a straight line. And whenever we talk about the dollar's weakening, probably like several days or maybe a week or two or maybe a few, the dollar is going to rise again. But those are trends, right, that happen. If you take the yen, one of the least popular currency, that, by the way, has the highest real interest rates in the major in the G4 space and amongst the top currencies. And it's been drifting higher, but whenever you look, it seems to be down for the day, right? And so, but if you look at it over weeks, there is a trend that it's been strengthening. And if, by the way, talking about the yen, the one risk-off currency, if there is one, is the dollar these days. I'm not saying that the dollar is as safe as it used to be, but because of those global reflationary offers, the waves, the moment that there's a flight. The flight is back into US dollars because people need to reduce the leverage because one of the hallmarks of this rally is that everybody's giving themselves up because they can't make any money in a cash and non-levered environment.
All right, Axel, we're wrapping it up there. Thank you for joining me on this weekend show. And again, if anybody is interested in tuning in to the webinar on January 14th, Thursday at 4:15 p.m. Eastern Time, you can click that link below within this weekend show posting. I hope everybody enjoyed this weekend show. Please, everyone, keep the emails coming, fleck@kereport.com. And please let me know what you think of all the companies that I'm bringing on the show, both the ones that I am following and the companies that I am introducing to all of you, because I glean a lot of insights from all of your emails and what you like and what concerns you about individual companies. So I thank you for all those emails that I continue to get. Axel, great chatting with you. Thank you for taking time on this weekend. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Have a great year.